This is Untold Magic.
Welcome back, guys. Today we have a really awesome guest. I'm so excited. Today we're going to be speaking with Miss Erica Buenaflor. Miss Erica, if you wouldn't mind just kind of like telling us a little bit about you, your background, just real brief for people who don't know who you are.
Yes, hi Taylor. Thank you so much for having me. I am a practicing curandera with well over 25 years of practicing and in curanderismo traditions. And for those of us who don't know what curanderismo is, it's essentially a Latin American shamanic healing practice that incorporates its roots are in Mesoamerica. And I'm also an author. This is my sixth book. My final book. One of the big things that inspired me, I draw a lot off of indigenous traditions because when I first started studying, because I studied both field and academically, I had four principal mentors in the Yucatan. And of course, my grandparents, my aunts. I grew up around a lot of traditional curanderismo healing practices, but I had mentors in the Yucatan that were very much rooted in indigenous traditions. And when I studied it academically, it was very much like, oh, well, we don't know exactly if this comes from Spain or if this comes from the indigenous peoples. And I kind of felt like that was a little bit lazy because those things can be rooted in indigenous traditions. It's just a lot of work. And that's what my book set out to do, is making those things accessible to mainstream audiences, especially with a lot of the misappropriation and misinformation of indigenous practices. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna do this. It's gonna take a lot of work. It's gonna be, and it has been. But yeah, here we are.
A labor of love. We love to see it. And it really does come through in your writing. Like you can really hear the passion behind what you're saying, which I'm so about. So a lot of my practice and what I talk about a lot is like decolonization and reclamation of a culture that a lot of us have had to like assimilate to another culture in order just for basic like survival, right? So this has been really, really cool. And just to kind of piggyback on that, like you talk about all these things in your book, but can you talk about like what does it mean for you to like for a practitioner to decolonize, reclaim all of those identities for themselves?
So in veneration rites of curanderismo, I explain I and it's in a footnote, and then I of course weave it in with decolonizing, and I define colonization because first, before we talk about decolonizing, it's like, okay, well, what is colonization? And identify too that it has two aspects. There is an external aspect where it's the colonization of the resources of the land, the goods, and of course the people as well. So there's extra, and that's what like is usually known as like external colonization. And of course there's also internal colonization, and that is essentially through the hearts and minds of people with economic, political, cultural institutions. And those are a little bit more insidious or just like overt. They're just, yeah, they're like kind of like very, they're sneaky, but they're still there. And the faces of the colonizer has definitely changed. So with that said, and that's, I mean, like, I feel it's very important too, that first and foremost in our practice set, we make a practice of defining these very contentious terms. That in and of itself is power, and saying, okay, well, let me define decolonizing. So decolonizing, when I talk about it in my practice and in my book, it is essentially reclaiming our agency to define our what is spirituality for us, because that has for a long time that was defined for us. It was like, okay, you had these traditions for hundreds of years. When the Spaniards came here, they basically imposed their traditions on us. And a lot of we resisted for hundreds of years in many different kinds of ways, and kept traditions. And it's looked different in many ways, right? So that's first and foremost is defining these terms. And as a practitioner, that we get used to saying, well, let me first tell you what this is before we assume that everybody's on the same page. So that's the first thing, right? Is defining these terms and, of course, decolonizing how I put it into practice in my book and also into praxis is that I ask people, well, what is faith to you? Some people say, oh, well, I'm not religious. I'm like, no, 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 no. Do you have faith in yourself? How do you feel when you're out in nature? Tell me about that.
That
because
is so
that's,
powerful.
Yeah, it's claiming your agency to be able to do that.
I loved in here you were talking about in the beginning, the liminal space. And I talk about that a lot personally, like just like how working in this type of work, you dwell in that liminal space. And so it was super validating for me, but I know for a lot of people who are going to be listening as well, because I do meet a lot of my listeners like in real life. And so I just really love that. So just an FYI, guys, like there's a lot of really good stuff in here as well. So are there like any practical ways that people can start their practice?
So practical ways, like for ancestral veneration?
Yes, sorry.
No, no worries, no worries. So practical ways for ancestral veneration. One is, you know, one is like first to go in and one of the things that I stress in the book is our ancestors and their ancestors, what they looked at wasn't just limited to blood. You know, yes, of course, but, you know, when family died, they passed away, they left a plate for them, they honored them, hopefully, right? Maybe. But generally, that was the general practice. It's still done. You know, it's still done. In Mérida, it's really beautiful. They have an extra plate that they have for folks that like in case they were forgotten. Right, they have an extra plate for Día de los Muertos, that is, that have this tradition of honoring. So one is to understand that ancestors went beyond blood. It included cultural, it included mentors, it included vocational ancestors, that like it went beyond, and also of course those that were leaders of the community and city states. And they had mythologies around that. And this is really important because a lot of us don't have a lot of the DNA and a lot of the records were changed. And it was changed to avoid forced labor systems for hundreds of years, discrimination, systemic discrimination. So a lot of our indigenous records have been erased or we didn't look this way. That's important because it's like, okay, well, how are we going to connect to our ancestors when some of that has been so erased, has been questioned? And there's some of us that do have that connection. It's to first understand that our ancestors went beyond blood. Yes, it was blood. So if you do have blood ancestors, if you do know your elders, of course, absolutely. So one is to tune into, you have an understand. Do we have an understanding of what is our culture? What culture resonates with you? You know, like if it's Maya, if it's, you know, some kind of indigenous, Mesoamerican indigenous, you know, if you don't have like the exact DNA, if you don't have that exact, that you tune into and you start reading and studying about it and let ourselves to go intuitively and work in that way too. And research, because we'll get led, and a lot of what we do, it's our ancestors working through us. A lot of what we do in terms of, you know, leaving copal out, leaving water out, leading offerings out, setting up altars, and the way we set up altars, a lot of what we do is our ancestors working through us. So the more and more we recognize that and we allow ourselves to open up to that, that our ancestors are always working through us and have been working through us, that is a good, that's a wonderful start because we open up that door even more. So I feel that that's like a good start of it is, we don't, if we know our blood, beautiful. If we don't, okay, to get in connection with our cultural ancestors, our vocational, that because that's what our ancestors did too, you know, and they did it for different reasons, but picking up that can be very empowering for us that we're continuing that tradition.
I always recommend for people to just kind of start somewhere, just really small. because, like, personally, in my own practice, when I first started, there was a lot of things that I was doing, and people would be like, "Why are you doing that?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but it feels right." And then actually reading some of your books, like, I didn't know what a White Fire Limpia was, and I remember reading your book and being like, "Oh my God, like, I do that. There's a name for it. It's not just this thing I started doing." Like, and I share that just as a way to say, like, you don't always, like, if you don't have that connection, you're not going to have the name for it or the proper term, but your spirit and the magic in your bones knows what to do. You just have to be willing to listen.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a really important start. That's a really important start to allow ourselves to open up to ancestral veneration. And those things are really important for many reasons.
So what about if people have ancestors who aren't like, let's say they want to work with certain ancestors and not with others because they have like different, like, because people, when they pass, they don't always lose those like biases, right? And so what would you recommend in those instances? Because I do have some clients and people that I've come across and they're like, well, like, I want to honor, my parent, but like they were a bad person in life. Like, so what would you recommend for that?
And this is something that I address a lot in my book. I address it like in chapter one, like who do we connect to? Is recognizing it's like, okay, we don't have to connect to everybody and recognize them as ancestors just because they were blood. There's going to be different points in our life that we might connect with them. We might offer them healing. We might not. And whatever space we're in, it's important for us to honor that. So, for example, on my ancestral table, I have a lot of relatives that have passed away. And every day I offer copal, weekly I change the water, I give them flowers, but I only work with two as ancestors. And I have a lot of other cultural ancestors on there as well. And those I do work with as ancestors on my team. When I do a lot of my limpia rites, when I do a lot of my brujería, those are the ones I work with. I honor, just like I was taught, I honor that there's a place to rest and you have a place to rest. But I'm not going to work with them, all of them as ancestors. And one day I might, but that's a space where we have to honor and we have to tune into, because that's also what my ancestors, our ancestors did. It's Mesoamerica. That's, they may have had a place for that, but that doesn't mean that they honored them as ancestors. And that was, you could see that by how they were treated after they passed away, where they were buried, what they did, the ceremonies afterwards. And if sometimes you were, you at least they had a plate for you, but you may not have had certain, ancestral veneration rites as certain leaders did.
Yeah, I think the distinction is important because I feel like whenever people are coming into these practices initially, like they feel, I guess, like overwhelmed or like obligated to venerate a particular ancestor spirit as an ancestor just because they were related. And so I really wanted to like touch on that for the people who are going to be listening. The point of my podcast is to, one, facilitate community, but two, to also offer people resources for questions.
It's definitely there for a lot of information. And when one of the things too I want to mention as well in terms of who we connect to is that, along with not necessarily connecting with everybody, is that, everybody that we recognize as that, is that we're really honoring ourselves in that practice, because a lot of these things were influenced by Christian traditions. And a lot of the things in the Bible is like this emphasis of honoring your mother, your father, your and that wasn't necessarily the case. I mean, not that we didn't honor that indigenous, we did, and we had a plate for them, we honored them, but it was just in a very different kind of way. Those distinctions, not and that's it's not good, it's not bad, it is what it is, but it's not something that like that really is a lot of it was imposed on us, that we're supposed to honor them because they are blood.
Definitely. You're gonna see, or just throughout the community, right? You see that so much where there's so much Christian influence within, like, and that's the other reason too that I wanted to talk about, like, what does decolonization mean for you, or how would you define that? Because some people think decolonization is completely re removing all Christian influences from like magic or from folk magic or what have you. that is completely different from other types of decolonization, which is just like indigenous practices don't have that, but like newer practices, folk Catholicism practices, like you can't remove the two. And so I just wanted to touch on that as well, because that is such a big portion. Like what you're talking about is indigenous practices, which is totally different from like Mexican or like, you know what I mean, practices.
Well, I mean, there's a lot too that I mentioned too in altar making, because that was like a big focus, is that that's blended. And I mean, with the altar making, El Día de los Muertos, I have like a bunch of pictures, and I have like calaca, like skeleton scenes, like, and that for me, I mentioned that was very healing for my inner child, like feeling dissociated, like not feeling discriminated, one too, when I came here to the States, and not feeling connected with being Mexican, because I was known as a gringa by my family, and then not feeling like I belonged here because I didn't look like them, or I didn't talk, I would, Spanish was my first language. So it, and there's those things of like, we don't necessarily have to throw things out, but we do identify what we do accept and what we don't. And that's how I identify what decolonizing is in this context, in this book. And someone might define it differently, and that's cool, right? That's our power. That's our agency to be able to do that. But ultimately, that is the agency of being able to say, this is what this means for me, and this is why this means for me. And these are the things that I've been influenced by. A lot of us have been influenced by, is looking at them and say, okay, well, where are the roots? What resonates with me? What's fun? Because I love El Día de los Muertos. I love dressing up. I love, the calaveras. And that was a big point for me too, is that, of reclaiming myself, reclaiming my family, reclaiming my father when he was shot, reclaiming him. And I honored him in an altar, in a huge altar. And that's definitely, we had those traditions in July and August. Indigenous, we celebrate it for 2 months, not just 3 days. We party, we know how to party. But I mean, the days that we're celebrating now those are Christian influences, So it's like, okay, well, what do we take, and how do we, but nonetheless, though, we do it differently than a lot of like what was done necessarily in Spain. How we did it, we like we just went all like, it's colorful, we have flowers, we have these amazing altars that we set up. How we have reclaimed it as ours is very different and beautiful.
And even within Latin America, like different regions celebrate differently. Like there are still some like really rural areas that will like dig up the bones and like wash the bones. And it's like the actual like bones, not like fake bones. Which in the more I guess, like Mexico City, like they wouldn't be doing that, So even within that context, like there's just so much variation. And I really appreciate you like talking about that, right? Because now as a people, we are all very mixed. Like there is no like we're all different cultures and regions and stuff. And so what someone's grandma over here does over here, someone's grandma over here may be similar but different, and it doesn't make them wrong or right. So I love that you talk about that.
And it's important, like, that we look at it and we share, we're willing to share that information when it's appropriate, right? And when we feel guided to share information and recognize that, okay, well, this was done this way, and that's wonderful, you did it this way, okay. And this is, and we also understand why we did, why our parents' parents, and going back, did the things that, why they did, and ultimately that we understand that. When we start creating and we start tracing and we start reclaiming that, whatever that is, because when our ancestors did that, that was very empowering for them. They created stories of like, well, this is why we're here on this land, because we were guided to be here on this land. It was a very empowering thing to do, and it rooted them into feeling a sense of belonging. And that's still something that we do for us when we have a sense of roots. We know our roots, and it's something that we reclaim, something that's divine and beautiful. And we allow ourselves to do that too. And we get comfortable with defining ourselves rather than being told what we should be.
I love that so much. Wow, I'm gonna go back and edit this and be like, dang, that was so profound. So, okay, we're talking about reclamation, we're talking about decolonization. Okay, so what would you say would be misappropriation and reappropriation in the context of veneration of your ancestors?
So, it's something that I've been noticing because I work a lot with Latinas, and I work with a lot of millennials and Gen. What I've been noticing a lot of Gen Zs is that they're scared. They're scared to reclaim their indigenous roots. They're scared that they feel they don't have a right to do that. They're scared of being judged to do that. They're scared. They're scared. They're scared. And I hear that a lot. They don't feel they look indigenous enough. They feel that they don't have that connection enough, which is very different. And I'm going to be like one of those old people, like, oh, back in my days, this is so, and I'm going to just do it. But back in like when I was like in my when I was like in my 20s, is I was very much like involved in a lot of the walkouts and the strikes when we were reclaiming Chicano Studies departments, especially at UCLA. We had walkouts, and this is in California particularly. They had this horrible governor, a very conservative, that instigated Proposition 187. It was like this fever of like this discrimination. 187 that basically prohibited any kind of non-emergency services to anyone that was an immigrant. Okay. And also Proposition, which actually was ruled unconstitutional by the California Supreme Court. And then Proposition 209, which basically dissolved affirmative action in California. So that basically woke up a sleeping dragon in a lot of us, and we were angry. We were angry. We were doing walkouts because we wanted the rights to be able to study our history. We wanted the right to be able to study our culture. So it would, and it, we were around a lot of, our professors, our teachers were like in this Chicano studies, like very active, very like, my blood is red, in your face. We didn't cross the border crossed us. Just like crazy. We were like, I was very much involved in that, where it wasn't a question of like, do I have the right to claim indigenous? It's like, mother, I'm gonna curse right now.
No, go for it. This is we're
Okay.
pro cursing here.
Okay, cool. Motherfucker, I am indigenous. Fuck you. Like, tell me, come tell me to my face. I am not indi like, I mean, that was like my generation. And what happened was, and there's a point in this too, and like linking this to that. What happened is that a lot of my generation, we got out of school, like including myself, we got involved. We got involved. I was, I got out, and I was working organizing janitors. I got involved in the movement in Mexico for the Zapatistas that were claiming sovereignty, agency to the land. It was we because we wanted to understand what was going on. We were very much interested in what was going on in the indigenous communities in Latin America, because we felt connected. We felt connected, and that was huge. And for the Zapatistas to claim San Juan Chamula as being sovereign, it's still sovereign to this day. And but a lot of indigenous peoples around the world, and then in also too in Guatemala, there was a Pan Maya movement that indigenous peoples that weren't Maya, but I mean they because it was like they were like being imposed, that name was being imposed on them, you're Maya, and they were not Maya, they were Quiche. They had, I mean, they were just different peoples, right? But they're like, you know what? We've been called Maya. We're going to reclaim, we're going to reappropriate that term, and we're going to tell you what Maya is. We're going to tell you what our spirituality is. We're going to claim our agency, our sovereignty. And this was like around 2010. And you started seeing this like a flood of indigenous peoples like throughout Latin America and Ecuador, just reclaiming rights to land, reclaiming this. And it alarmed a lot of governments. And this is part of the
As it
internal,
should.
yeah, but this was part of the internal colonization, that the term appropriation, like they started claiming this, like, because when I was in school, in grad school, like the term appropriation wasn't a bad word. It was like understanding it's like it was basically cultural development, right? But there was definitely misappropriation when you claimed, when you started basically using and drawing from culture, from especially people that were have been historically marginalized, without giving them without giving them props, without saying, this is where this come from, this is where I learned it from. They just did it. They just did it. So there was that distinction. What was very problematic is that during this time is they started putting this thing of cultural appropriation and appropriation. And what has happened now to this day, because it has started creating a divide that even the Gen Zs, they don't feel connected to their indigenous roots, where our back, my generation did feel connected. We did feel connected, and we very much claimed that right. We very much claimed it, and we wanted to make sure it was in our schools, make sure we had our children's children had access to that information. And it's somewhat like insidious. So basically, like misappropriation, it's still what it is. Appropriation is, it's something that is common. That's what is, I mean, that's the development of Catholicism, of Christianity, of any culture. We take, we borrow, we claim, we have, there's war, there's so many different factors involved, right? That's cultural development. That's cultural development. There's reappropriation with people who have been historically marginalized that were like, "Fuck you, we're going to reclaim our rights." Okay, this is what a lot of Indigenous people were doing back in 2010, and then thereafter for about 10 years until like they've been silenced a lot. They've been silenced a lot, and this concerns me too because a lot of like the younger generations, they're not getting involved anymore. They're not getting involved anymore because there's this disconnect of like, I don't have that right to claim my Indigenous roots.
And I'm going to get a little conspiracy theorist here, and I do feel like some of that is on purpose. So, like, I'm super pro, like, let's talk about misappropriation. Let's talk about, decolonizing and racism and systemic, all these things, right? And I think that cancel culture initially started as a good thing, right? Cancel culture meaning like these people are being genuinely, like, overtly racist, and we are not going to support them for doing that, right? But now it's come to the point to where people are afraid to even ask questions or to, like you said, connect with anything, because of that fear of the cancel culture. And so, although I'm not totally anti-cancel culture, like, yes, please, let's cancel these celebrities that are, or these people that are just doing all these awful things, cancel them. But on the same token, like, we have to make sure that we're still leaving room for growth,
Yeah, we have to be like really ask ourselves, okay, where am I creating alternative spaces? Where am
And
I
that's
creating?
it.
What am I doing? How am I doing this? So we allow ourselves to still, because a lot of the indigenous peoples in Latin America, they don't have like they don't have the privileges that we have here to social media. And we have that, and that's what allowed a lot of the attention that just shining the light on what's going on. A lot of the oil spills, a lot of the pollution in the land, not having access to clean water. It's they had those things. They had a lot of those things because a lot of us were going there and were bringing attention to this. But when there's just a huge disconnect, 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 the disconnect just keeps growing. Disconnect, it keeps growing. So it's like being aware. It's like, okay, how do we connect to this? How do we connect and how do we reclaim these identities? And we feel proud, we feel happy. And also, too, that it infuses our magic and what we do because our ancestors are soul energies and they bring that magic into our limpia rites, our brujería. Like anything that I do on my ancestor altar that's infused with my ancestors and I've connected with them, it's unstoppable.
What are some, like, tangible things that people can do to connect with their ancestors? Like, I know you were talking earlier about, like, putting flowers, all those things. Like, what are some things that people can do today to help them to start connecting?
Well, is an and this is something that I break down to in the book. Like chapter one, it's like when you're beginning. Some of the things that you're beginning, it's one of the things that I have different things that I recommend. It's if you're beginning, maybe writing a love letter and putting it next to your bed because it's believed that when we sleep, our soul energy, known as our tonali, goes into the non-ordinary realms where our ancestors are at. So what was done is that we left ofrendas by where we slept to for our ancestors. So we can leave an offering, we can leave flowers, and we could just start connecting with them in setting up an altar for them. And talk about like different ways we can have a temporary altar, a permanent altar, or start infusing it with the medicine bundle, and that's a cloth that we We infuse it with our ancestors' energies. And we can also, of course, just very simply like write them a song. Write them a song, create stories for them. We can connect with them by going to some of these sacred sites and honoring them, because the energies are there in the rocks, the energies are there in the temples. The energies are there, and bring and offer and bring offerings. We can bring, copal, we can bring, our favorite flowers to a lot of these to these sacred sites, and bring them as ofrendas to them and ask them, like, please connect with me. Thank you for connecting with me. And that's also very important too, is that we start from the presumption that they have been connecting with us. Rather than asking us, how do we connect? We say, thank you for connecting with me. Thank you for guiding with me. Because if we're starting with presumption of, well, how do we connect? We're still leaving that question is, are we actually connecting? Rather than accepting that we are connecting.
I love that because it's true. You do have that presumption, right? And or that, I guess that inherent perception that like you're just not listening, whatever is really sometimes you're just not reaching out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we invite them to eat with us, with us or with our family, and we serve them. What's traditionally done is we get a feather and we fan the food and invite them for the first, because it's believed that sense is what ancestors are composed of. That's what they're comprised of. That's what they consume, and that's also what they are. So when we make it, whenever we're eating, we fan the food and we welcome them to sit with us. We ask them questions and we accept that they're guiding us. And we'll notice that throughout the days, throughout the weeks, synchronicities will happen where they do guide us. Synchronicity will happen where doors will open up for us, things will open up for us where we know that we are being guided towards something or away from something. So, and just making a practice, whether it's in the morning, where we're eating, it doesn't have to be anything complicated. It can be, and it can be ritual, like many of the things that I mentioned too, like gazing in my book is getting a picture and gazing with them, but doing very simple things like eating with them and asking them questions.
A big one for me is that so I work a lot with like my grandmother, and she was real like chismosa, and so I'll just sit there with her sometimes and just like tell her all the gossip, like and for me that's how like that's something we used to do when I was younger, and so I just wanted to share that too because it doesn't always, like you said, doesn't always have to be something super complicated. Sometimes just like grandma, guess what?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that like my grandfather, like he loved coffee. He was a cafetero. Like he loved milk with coffee, and that's how I serve it for him. It's like how he loved it, what he did. And then there's also too, like, our cultural ancestors, like people that we feel really connected to. Like one of them for me is a Chingona, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. She was one of the first, well, I would say the first, but really she was a feminist, I should say. She was a Mexican, like she was really outspoken. She criticized in the and this is in the 17th century. She gained a lot of power as a woman. She gained a lot of power, and she criticized outspoken about the church and their misogyny within the church. And she wrote everything from literature, from like different kinds of symphonies. She wrote, she knew Nahuatl, Spanish, she knew Latin. Very, very intelligent, just brilliant lady. And that's someone that I feel very much connected to. And I have her on my altar when I need to get into like my chingona. Like I need to connect with that, like I need that inspiration. And like I call upon her because she was not afraid about like telling someone like, no, you're
I love
wrong.
that. I love that. And can you repeat her name again? Because now I'm interested.
Yeah, it's Sor Juana, Sor. Juana is Juana. Ines, Inez de la Cruz, Cruz. Yeah,
Awesome. I'm
she's the.
excited because that's a whole vibe right there.
Yeah, and you know, and then there's others too that I worked with too, Maria Sabina,
Oh,
who worked in
yeah.
the Masa traditions with the Santos. That I have a big picture of her, and I've like very much connected like with those that we feel just culturally too connected to, like our cultural like heroes that we feel this strong connection with.
I love that. So I know we've been talking about your book and the topics in your book, but I kind of wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about you. So for the people who don't know you, I wanted to ask you about like your start, right? Like, of course, you know, this is part of our culture, but like you particularly, your start of your spiritual path, like how did that come about?
The first limpia that I ever performed when I was 5 years old.
We love to see it.
I had a friend that was low on energy, and I cleansed him, and I used water, but then I also used the battery too.
Yes, symbolism.
So this is going to give you energy. So I mean, this was very much, and you know, I was like 8 years old when I made my first like small tincture, but it was actually with the. It was like more of a, it was more, what was it? Like, it wasn't using alcohol, but it was using hibiscus, and it was actually for my throat to help because I had a sore throat. And I heard the flower tell me, like, oh, you know, use, you know, drink me because you have a sore throat. It actually cleared my sore throat and put lemon. And I just would listen a lot. And I was an only child, so I worked a lot with plants. So there was, you know, I was very fortunate to, and then my mom was always, you know, this was not the best thing all necessarily, but she was always at work. So I was very fortunate in the sense that for a large part, like I got to be around like nature. And I wasn't being like restricted. I wasn't being restricted. And I would talk to like ghosts and spirits. I'd see them be like, you know, like it wasn't a thing out of the ordinary for me. It never really got shut down. I've always been like a weird one throughout my life. And then when I got to college, something opened up too when it was like, you know, because I was told, like, as I mentioned this in the book, like a lot of my book was also decolonizing myself too. My mind, my body, my spirit. Because I grew up being told, like, oh, you know, you're lucky if you don't look like your father, because he looked like an Indio. He looked indigenous. You know, and I was told that like my last name, that was my father's name, but none of this made me sound like a wetback. You know, so like all like it I was just constantly, it was like really like this was like forced up, like really just hounded on me. So I was like healing my mind, my body, and my spirit, like me, my soul. And a lot of it happened when I got in my Chicano studies classes, when it was like, oh, my ancestors were pretty fucking awesome. You know, they were amazing, and reclaiming myself. So a lot of that came, and as I mentioned, a lot of that came at the time when there was a lot of activism. So my activism was very much infused. My spirituality was very much infused with that activism. That was important because, you know, when I got out of school, it was like, you know, start out as a labor organizer, and then, you know, then I went to law school. So to continue on that route of like working nonprofits and being of service, all this stuff, right? I was really like idealism. But in law school, I met on a trip that I thought was just gonna just go with my friend to like have a nice time in Yucatan. I met one of my first mentors, and I got a limpia from him. And he, you know, and I shared with him about my great great grandmother was a very well known curandera. And he told me, he's like, Mija, your grandmother, like just like your great great grandmother, you're also a curandera. And because I told him, you know, he asked me, what are you going to do? I'm like, oh, I'm going to be an attorney. I'm going to go to law school. And he's like, began laughing. He's like, you're not going to like it. And I was like, okay. And he's like, you're a curandera. And I'm like, and I dismissed it, but I continued going back to him. I continued going back to him for like 6 years, to him and another lady who was a sobadera, Barbara. So I continued working with them. And, you know, even this is like, you know, already when I was an attorney, I was still, and I didn't know why I was doing it. Just for me, it was like more healing and reclaiming myself. That was, it wasn't necessarily to be a curandera. It was more of, you know, they were teaching me how to do these things, and they were, you know, providing limpias for me. But a lot of it was like what I started, what I was guided to do, is because I felt like I was, and I was definitely reclaiming my spirit, reclaiming my indigenous heritage, reclaiming, because they were, you know, my ancestors, there was like very much like the mentors were very much rooted in Maya or Nahua traditions. So I got exposed to that a lot. And then I had a catastrophic injury. You know, 2005, I fell off a cliff, as I also mentioned in my book. And I woke up with a skull fracture, brain hemorrhage, left AC dislocated, two vertebrae in my back fractured, completely shattered my coccyx, left leg I fractured in three places, right leg knee down, all of my bone shattered and came out of my heel. And prior to that, you know, I was working as an attorney doing nonprofit work. I was like going doing social justice work, but I was also doing Linkus for people too. I was also teaching a lot of, you know, teaching about like energy work. And so I was in those worlds were not like they were separate to some degree because I was working in them separate. I couldn't announce myself as a curandera and as an attorney. You know, it's not something that like it's like even today it wouldn't necessarily be something that's accepted per se. Yeah, it wouldn't, you know, so, but I definitely continued doing it. I didn't stop. I didn't stop. It was still something that I was very passionate about. While people were trying to make partner, I was still going there and getting mentorships. I was still going there and I was teaching and I was bringing this traditions and doing limpias for people. And for me, it was reclaiming my indigenous spirit. It was a reclaiming of my great grandmother's ways and the way she healed, the way we did things. So how it was very, but at the same time, it was very hard for me too, because, you know, a lot of, there's still a lot of in my family too, a lot of this, oh, but we have more Spanish blood. I'm like, no bullshit.
Oh my gosh, yes. I call it othering, right? It's you're not like those Mexican people. You're not like those Hispanic people. You're different. You're not indigenous, you're Spanish. Like, so yeah, that is very much a thing. Sorry, I just wanted to interject.
No, that's so it was like going like and then seeing that too in you know crossing the border when I'd go from Juarez to El Paso, like you know seeing the Tarahumara, like the indigenous people like begging and like asking like why is this here? I didn't understand it. Why what is what did I didn't under, and I'd ask questions and they would give me very and basically it would tell me, oh well, they don't want to work. And that was not satisfactory to me. I was like, no, there's more than this. There's something else. And but being in that, even in my family, you know, just in my family is beautiful, but there was that. It's like very much in, like it's insidious. It's there, and in a lot of the families, a lot of our families is that othering, right? So moving through that within myself of because I told my mom that I was doing these things, and my mom was kind of like, what? Like, but honey, you're an attorney, and I was like, but I'm being like. You know, because this was during my accident too. Because I went and I asked her. You know, I was in the hospital, Mom. I need my medicine bundle. I need my herbs. I need this. I need all these things so I can get better. And she saw me getting better because that was also a big thing too. And it was, I think, at that point where there was some acceptance from my family because they were like, okay, you know, we don't want Erica to stay in a wheelchair because I was in a wheelchair for almost a year. But you know, they were like a little bit more accepting of me and open because they saw me healing so quickly. And that's when I started coming out to my family. I mean, they kind of knew it, but they were just like, at that point, they were just like, okay, we're gonna listen because you've been in a lot of pain. We're not gonna be, you know, we're not gonna be jerks. We're gonna, I mean, they just were like more open to it. But then when I got better, it was at a point of like, I did good work and I still did. I mean, you know, for a long time, I still did good work, social justice cases as an attorney, but it just got to a point where it was just no longer my passion. And after almost dying, I had to really ask myself, do I want to continue living a life that I'm not really feeling passionate about? I'm feeling really, you know, constrained about like this is, and that was, it was, so that transition was incredibly painful in the sense of, you know, and then my family, like, what are you doing? Are you like, you know, you hit your head, you know, like let yourself heal. Think you've lost it there, you know, because then I went like, well, I thought like, okay, well, maybe I'll go back to school, like, and I'll study it that way and they'll accept me that way. But then I went to school and I saw there was a lot of like problems there. And it's like, you know what? I don't want to be the curandera studying curanderas. I am the curandera. I want to embody these traditions.
I love
So
that.
I mean, like it's cool when I see like for me personally, it was something that was, it took me 18 years to identify myself as a curandera, even though I practice regularly doing limpias, and that's also, you know, that you take on that name when like, and my community was definitely recognizing me as that, you know, as a healer. That's my curandera, that's my, sometimes they call me shaman, whatever, but I didn't embrace that term. It took me 18 years to actually be like, you know what, I came out, like it was like coming out of the closet for me with my family, like this is who I am, this is like forever, like this is what I do, I'm embracing myself 100%. And it was, and it's like that because of all of the things of colonization in our culture. And like, it's complex. It's not linear. It's not, it's messy. It's fun. It's beautiful. And it's hard. And it's just this, all these things and flowing in it.
100%. Like, I resonate so much with your story. So I went to school for biotechnology and I have a degree in that, which is basically like genetic engineering. And now like I do this full time. And my family was the same way. They were like you have a whole degree, like go to work. So I totally get it in that sense too. Anywho, I just thought it was so crazy. You were talking about it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I feel that so hard. So I wanted to ask you, everybody has like one crazy story that is either really cool or unexplainable or crazy that they've witnessed. Do you have one that you would like to share today?
I'm going to share the one that I shared in my book. I have so many. I'm going to share the one that I shared in my book. This was back in 1999. And I was, this was in between, I was going to go and do a full moon ceremony at Temazcal. This is a sweat lodge ceremony. And I was going and you know, the curandero was asking me to go get herbs, and I went and got all the herbs for him. And I bought like maybe $10 with me. I didn't have a lot of money. And prior to that, like I got there and I was walking around and I saw these beautiful medicine bundles. It was these hides that were just, that had all these different scenes of creation of the Maya calendar, just beautiful bundles that were, they were like about $75, like the ones that I was looking at. They weren't cheap. And you know, I went and I went and got the herbs for our ceremony that day. And then I was like, okay, well, I have some time in between and I'm gonna just go walk up and down. This is Playa del Carmen. And this was back in the day where it was a very sleepy little town. Now it's like hustling. There's all like, it's huge. It's like, it's, yeah, it's very, very like noisy and very touristy. But back in the days, it was like one street where the stores were at, right? Just one street, one street, one street where like, that's where the tourists were at, like tourist stores, right? And they had like other stores too, but like, no, this like one main street where they had all the stores and they had a couple restaurants and it was very small, low key. And I'm walking around and I go into one of the stores and I see this beautiful medicine bundle and it's the round calendar and it's the Maya calendar. And I go and I approach it and I'm just falling in love with it. And I, the lady, the beautiful little Mayan lady that comes over, she comes over to talk to me. And I start remembering what the glyphs meant, what they meant, what they were like. I like, it was like a remembering. It wasn't, I had never studied them. Now I have studied them, but I never studied, but I knew what they were. It was just this intuitive remembering. And I started telling her, I'm like, this is what that means. And she looked at me and she looked at me so happy. And I knew that was supposed to be my bundle. And then I asked her nervously because it was like a bundle that the bundles that size that I looked at, as I mentioned, were about $75, right? And I asked her, well, how much is it? And she looked at me, she's like, well, how much money do you have? And I reached into my pocket and I knew I only had like, I had like less than $10, you know? And I just pulled out like the change and I pulled out everything. I pulled it out and I looked at her and she just looked at me and she smiled and she's like, it's yours. And then, so the next, so, you know, I went and I took it with me to the Temazcal and I took it out with me. I took it into the, it was like this initiating. I was initiating the medicine bundle and that night, you know, I'm looking at it with the full moon and it was just this, I got this flash. Kept getting these flash in my third eye, it, just remembering so many beautiful things. So the next day, you know, because these people like, that's the money. That's how they make a living, right? I wanted to go back and I wanted to pay her the difference. I wanted to pay her the difference of what the medicine bundle was. So I'm there and I'm walking up and down the street looking for the store so I can pay her back. Taylor, I could not find the store. I spent a few hours. I asked everybody where the store was at, and everybody was like, no, there's no store like that. And there was only one street, and I was only on that one street. There was one street I walked up and down, that store was gone. It was just gone. And it was my ancestors came and were like, yeah, that's supposed to be yours. That was, and I, when I do work on that, when I do my magic on there, when I like it just comes in, it's amazing. It's always amazing. And it's yeah. So that's
Oh my gosh. That would freak me out. I would be like, oh my gosh, like, did I just see a ghost?
No, they were just having fun. They were coming from another dimension. They're like, hey, what's up?
Yeah. They're like, no big deal, just
You're supposed to
opening
be working for
portals.
this. This is your medicine bundle. This is your first one. Go for
I love that.
it.
So, where can we find your book?
You can find it. I've seen it at pretty much every local bookstore. There's not one book that doesn't have Veneration Rites of Curanderismo. Of course, the bigger ones too, Barnes and Noble and Amazon. But I would say if you can support your local bookstore, support your local bookstore.
And where can we find you? Like, where, how do we get in touch with you? What services do you offer? Just like shameless plug-in.
So, realizeyourbliss.com, the website. And then, of course, I have a lot of the services I offer there are Olympias, remote in person, soul retrieval sessions. Of course, I do like hybrid where I help people connect with ancestor and heal ancestor like curses and things like that, because that also comes up too. And I talk about that too in the book. And also to divination readings, things like that. But of course, you do readings and they're amazing also.
Don't worry.
And then of course I'm on IG. Erica.Bonaflor_curandera. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Erica. This has been so cool. Like, I love your work. I'm a big fan. So, this was like so exciting for me to do this. So, I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I love your work too, and I'm very grateful for have, you know, that you invited me. Thank you.